just like to thank everyone else again who's read for us to help us get the meeting started. And I'll take this opportunity to welcome those that may have joined us since we first started the meeting. If you're visiting our meeting, welcome. We're glad that you're here. And if you're new to Narcotics Anonymous, a huge welcome. And we hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we are a speaker meeting tonight. We are an hour and a half meeting, so we have a good long meeting to go out. And our speaker is going to share for us for 40 or 45 minutes, wherever she's comfortable with. I've got to say, I'm actually delighted to have Teresa join us tonight. Welcome. We're glad that you're here. Her partner shared for us a while ago, and I felt it appropriate that we should get the boss to come and share as well. So our paths have crossed once or twice over the years, I think. I think we swapped likes on Facebook on craft pages a little while ago, and I was, you know, really intrigued and delighted to be able to welcome you to our meeting tonight. And I'm looking forward to hearing your share. So, Teresa, please share your experience, strength, and hope with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. Great. Computer keeps saying resolving network issues, so I don't know what that means. But I'm Teresa, I'm an addict.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
Welcome.
Thank you. Let me look at my clock here. 5:10. Okay. All right. So I've actually been looking forward to this. So I'll start with how I grew up, because that really plays into my life today. So I grew up in a family of 9 brothers and sisters, so there's 10 of us. And I realized recently the only time I remember having that I have good memories of when I was a kid was when I was at someone else's house, never at my own. And so my home was very violent. My dad had a rage issue and would beat us up pretty regularly, cuss at us, yell at us. Even spit in my face one time when I was like 10 for something I did, not on purpose, but you know, it's like you never knew when you're going to get in trouble for whatever, just walking across a room or something. And he was also like a racist, you know, he was just mean. And my mom was unemotional, did not advocate for us, and she just wasn't emotionally available. And so as far as I always felt like I grew up without a mom, basically. And I mean, she's still alive, and they didn't get a divorce, and you know, so she's always been my mom, but I was always looking for someone else to be my mom. And so I've actually had friends I would call their mom's mom, you know, and they were, you know, I found women, older women that were, you know, mom age, that were loving to me. And so also I was, I have 6 brothers. 3 of them are older, and those 3 were molesting my and the next door neighbor's dad. We would play with the kids. They were around our age, but their dad was doing that also. And I can, from what I can remember, and through therapy and steps and bits and pieces, this whole thing, the violence, the everything, went on from the time I was 2 years old till 14. When I was, there was a point in growing up where I knew that I was gonna use drugs. I wanted to, my older brothers did, and there was, even though what they were doing to me, I looked up to them in a way where they, because they could, they seemed to do whatever they wanted and were to take the consequences, which was the wrath of my dad. And besides all that, I had an older sister that when she was 13 and I was about 7, she had she was schizophrenic, and it started where she was hearing voices and she'd run away, and you know, and this was in the 60s, so she went in and out of the state hospital. We were living in LA, so it was the Camarillo State Hospital. Ever since she was 13, and back then, mental illness was a stigma. You don't really tell your friends that you have someone like that in your family. She was on like heavy, heavy drugs and getting shock treatment from, I mean, she was just a teenager, barely a teenager. So she never went to school again. She was institutionalized. And then I have a sister that is about 2 years older than me. And right before she turned 9, she got hit by a car, and she was in the hospital for a long time. She was in a coma for like 6 weeks, you know, and so I was probably 7 then. So a lot of things happen around that age. And those are just some of the things, though. So like my childhood was just piled on with that kind of stuff. And so my first escape was because I really didn't have anywhere to go. I always had to share a room with my sister. And we were, I don't know, it was very regimented at work. I mean, at work, at home, as to, you know, what days do you take a bath, and what, you know, when do you do this, when do you do that? And I suppose, you know, that makes sense with a large family. But besides all that, we were beating each other up pretty bad. And so it just, you know, and having to go to school, which I hated, but, you know, I hated school. I just basically hated my life. And except for going to my friends' houses, you know, their parents seemed to like me. My friends liked me. And that was my respite. And my other one was reading books. I could get lost in a book for hours. Depending on the book I read, if, you know, if it was a book with family in it, I became part of the family. And when the end of the book was coming near, it was like, there goes my family. I got to find a new one. You know, I had a very vivid imagination and daydreaming life besides that. And I would, just to go to sleep at night, I would make up stories in my mind. You know, start daydreaming so I could fall asleep, and I would keep that same story going on for a long, long time. So I just wanted out. I didn't feel like I fit in with the family, like these are not my people. I had to pretend everywhere I went that this was not all happening to me. And so my whole life was like a big old secret, you know, and that's a lot to carry for a kid, you know, and I couldn't wait to do drugs. I knew my brothers did because they were always getting busted. The cops would be at our house. And one of my brothers, when he was the oldest of all of us, when he was 15, he got kicked out of our house and he was in a foster home. We went to church every single Sunday. And then after church, we would go to Camarillo to go visit my sister. And so it was a very chaotic life in a lot of ways, but very regimented at the same time. There was a point where we were living in LA, Los Angeles, California, where I grew up. And then when I was like 13, almost 14 years old, my dad says that we're moving. And like I said, my respite were my friends and going to their houses. And so I was getting torn away from that, and we moved. I don't know how many, it was, I don't know, I want to say like 2,000 miles away to this little town called Williston in North Dakota. And I'd never seen snow. I didn't know how to, you know, make new friends. You know, the new kid on the block isn't very welcomed, or I wasn't in that situation. But I did finally get my own room, so that was, but it was a really super traumatic time in my life. And my daydream then was that there would be, where I was living in LA, there was this alley that we all played in, and we'd play basketball and frisbee and all that kind of stuff. And that my daydream was, at the end of the alley, there was this hole that I could go through. And so when I was like living in North Dakota, I would go through this hole and get to the alley and be with my friends, you know. And I was just so sad and so lonely. And I remember praying so hard to God, like, why am I here? And why, if you're real, why is this happening? You know, and it was just really horrible. It was cold there. There was snow. I've never experienced anything like that before. It was just complete culture shock. It was in the 70s. They dressed different. They talked different. The weather was completely different. It was just horrible. And we were in that place for a year and a half. And we went to a bigger town, which is the capital of that state, and never told why we were moving. You know, and when we moved to Bismarck, we were suddenly in government housing, eating government food, in a 3-bedroom apartment. And by then there were 3 girls and 3 boys left. Everybody, you know, the older ones had gone. I think some of them had joined the army, you know, and this was during like the Vietnam War and stuff. And I went to this one junior high and found friends. This place was a little bit easier, and I was able to start using finally. And that's from that point on, the time that I first started using, I was open and running. I just loved it. I loved that I wasn't shy when I was high, because I had such low self-esteem. And, you know, the way that I was being treated and grown up, you know, and my dad, after he would beat me up, he would be like, all of a sudden we're best buddies or something. It was really kind of gross, where he would never apologize, but now he's going to be talking to me really nice and stuff. And I remember that happening there too. There was the last time I ever got beat up. And once we moved there, I wasn't being molested anymore, because all those brothers were gone. And so maybe that, it just occurred to me, maybe that's why that place wasn't so bad. And also the using was helpful. I loved it. I loved that I could go places and be with people and get high and listen to music and meet new people and, you know, almost kind of be popular. It was really something for me. And I just, you know, when it was just, I started carrying a purse so I could bring my like drugs and alcohol to the school, and drinking in the bathroom, smoking in the bathroom. I smoked cigarettes, and I became the person that hung out with all the people that were doing all that kind of stuff. And really, really was so glad I found that. I mean, it was like my, oddly enough, my sanity. And then I didn't do well in school ever. and I'm not stupid. I know that. I know I'm really pretty smart, but I just never did well. I realize now that I had a lot of my energy towards keeping this huge secret of life, of what was being done to me, and trying to act normal and whatever that was, or like nothing was going on. At the same time, I really wanted someone to ask me, what's it like at home, or something, someone with authority, so that something could be done. And so this way of growing up has really caused a lot of damage. And, you know, I've read a lot about it. I've done a lot of work around it, and it actually alters your brain. And then you put using on top of that, and being a drug addict. And as soon as I started, from the time I started till the time I stopped, there probably wasn't a day or more that I wasn't using. And I was obsessed with it. And talking about it, the ways and means to get more, you know, that's what my life was about. And then when I turned 18, on the day of my birthday, I left home and I went back to LA. And I eventually got an apartment with a friend that I had known since fourth grade. And back in those days, you know, we didn't have internet or anything like that. We wrote letters back and forth, and to save up my allowance so I could make a phone call so I could talk to one of my friends, because it costs money to talk long distance on the phone. And that was my lifeline, those letters and saving up my money and talking on the phone. And we wrote letters, my friends and I, back and forth pretty much, I think, the whole time. I stayed in contact with them. And so I was able to, when I got back to LA, stay with the family that was my best friend's family. And she, of course, you know, wasn't living in the house anymore, but they let me stay there. And the mom was one of them that she would let me, when I was a kid, sit in her lap, and she'd show me how to knit, you know. And I remember fairly recently telling Ron this and crying, because like that was one of my good memories. And then I ran into one of my, or I don't know what happened, but this person that I had known since I was in fourth grade, and we'd been writing letters back and forth, and her and I ended up getting an apartment. And it turned out she used like I did. And that was really great for me. And so anyway, it all started unraveling about 9 months later. I started hitting bottom. I didn't know what to do with myself. I had been working in an old folks home, and I was a nurse's aide, and I really loved it, and the old people really liked me, and I'd gotten our apartment had gotten robbed one night, but also I was sort of thinking, this isn't working either. It's time to move on. I don't know what to do. And so that being robbed was like the answer to getting out of there. Like, cause I needed something. I couldn't just decide on my own, you know, okay, it's time to go, you know. And I was only 18. And so I went and told the place where I worked that I was leaving. I told my roommate, and my work, when I went back to pick up my paycheck, had thrown me a going away party. And I had only been there like 8 months at that job. And so that really felt good. And then later on, I ended up in treatment, and the old people there that were my patients wrote me letters, and I got an envelope full of all these different letters and cards, because they thought I was sick, that I was in the hospital, and they're all like these get well cards, and my friends in Bismarck did the same thing. It was really kind of cool. But anyway, I ended up catching a ride with my dealer's brother across the Midwest, and he dropped me off in Bismarck, And I started staying with people here and there on the couch, and I didn't have a job. So I was essentially homeless, jobless, 18. And to make a long story short, I ended up in treatment. And I didn't know why I was there 2 months. And it was 2 weeks in where I realized that I was at the in the right place at the right time. And I was so I realized that 2 weeks into treatment that I'm an addict and that there's help hope for me and this is why I'm here. And so I really started taking myself on while I was in treatment. And I didn't really know when the time came to leave where I was going to go. But while I was there, I had actually worked some steps, which I didn't really know what those were. I didn't know anything about NA. I didn't know anything about anything, except for I was glad to be there. And for one thing, I had my own bed and food to eat and stuff like that, you know. And I had everything that I had in one suitcase. And so when I got out, this woman that got out before me that, you know, I got along with well and stuff, she lived in this town called Fargo, North Dakota. And so she said I could live with her and for a while until I got set up. And so I went there. I'd never been to that town before. I didn't know anything about it. And I went there and I lived with her and she started drinking and she had three kids and it was pretty chaotic. And one thing that I didn't mention is that I go through depression off and on through my whole life. And that was another good thing about using. I was just self-medicating a lot. I was also interested in spirituality back when I was in high school and stuff even. And so some of the drugs I used had to do with that. But so anyway, I ended up, just to cut through it, I ended up using one more time. I realized that wasn't what I wanted to do. This is not how I'm going to live my life. And before I got into treatment, the reason I was going in there was that I was going to kill myself. And my brother mentioned treatment and I'm like, okay, I'll try that. And if this doesn't work, then I'm going to kill myself, you know? And so then at this point, when I used again after treatment, I'm like, I got suicidal again. And I don't know if I would say suicidal because there's not like a full-on plan that I have or would have, but just the idea of thinking that, well, I could always die was always a relief to me. Even today when I get that, I still get that way. That just the idea that I could always take myself out if I need to, you know, I know that I'm not the only one that thinks that way. And so that's where I was. I finally called the person that I was supposed to call when I got out of treatment. It was a counselor that I'd been set up with. And he offered me a job. And I had like 2 weeks clean at that point. And then all of a sudden, I'm working in recovery. And he saved my life. And that's where I learned about it. He told me to keep the job, I had to go to NA meetings. And I had to stay clean. And I was so shy and I didn't drive yet. I had to call. So I'd gotten a number from somebody and this is the guy that gives everyone rides and he would come and get me and the car would be full and we'd go to the meeting and oh my God, it was so scary. And we only had one meeting a week at the time. And so I would go and I didn't share for like the first 8 months of being clean. But I've stayed clean this whole time. So I was 18 when I got clean. I just turned 61 years old and I've been clean for 42 years. And so what I want to tell you next is my recovery you know, it's been slow, and I think that there's an advantage to people that get clean now and to people that get clean when NA became a bigger deal, because we'd be going to our meeting and people would show up and stay clean, and then when they had about 9 months clean, this is 1978 and on, when they had about 9 months clean, would go to AA then, and we wouldn't see them again unless we went to an AA meeting. And when I had a year clean, I found out that people were like supplementing the NA by going to AA also. And so I did that for about 2 years. When I had 3 years clean, I realized I need to pick a program, and I chose NA. NA, my people. AA just never was. I felt like a spy there, you know, like I don't quite belong there. And the guy that was giving me the rides was Ron. He's here, Ron H. And we've gotten a relationship. I had a year clean and he had like 3 months. And we've been married 38 years and we've been together for 41, I guess. And we have two kids and a grandkid, and it's a pretty good life. So, but what I want to talk about is my recovery from the way that I grew up. You know, I've realized fairly recently that what I have, you could call a mental illness. I have depression and I have complex PTSD and I have addiction. And there are things I've lived with that I didn't know why. I just knew that I needed to learn how to take care of myself. Some of those are, I just learned in the last 2 years that there are words that I didn't know, like trauma and being triggered. And I've worked countless steps, and they are magical. The steps are such a gift. I have learned through the steps who I am. I have found a higher power. I have a very intimate relationship with my higher power. And I want to say in that realm, because it's not just a one entity thing or whatever, but it's very intimate. And I have learned to have a regular practice, and that is so important to me, to sit in the same spot around the same time, mostly every day, and to write in a journal, to read something spiritual, and just sit quietly and meditate. It doesn't, like some people ask, how long do you meditate? And I go, I don't know. I was just having this conversation the other day with somebody and he's like, I do 30 minutes. I try to do 30 minutes. And I'm like, it doesn't matter how long I do it. What matters the most, and it's the same as NA meetings, is that I show up. That's what matters, that I just show up. And from, I learned the meditation, like importance of doing the same thing all the time like that through going to meetings and, you know, through working the steps. And I started putting things into place before I realized that just how bad the trauma has affected me. And by bad, I mean I can't handle large noise, you know, big loud noises. They trigger me. I don't even know. Just a lot of things do. I can't have my back to a door when I'm somewhere, so I make sure I don't when I'm in a restaurant or I'm at a meeting or something. But there's, I've had to really go through some hard things, like look straight at what was done to me through the steps and the steps and a sponsor have provided that for me. And it's, as you all know, that work steps, it's a courageous, loving act to be working steps, because that's not for the weak, you know, if you're really going to dig in and do it. But the results are just amazing. And I have come from this shy, minus self-esteem woman to, or girl actually, to where I'm this confident woman, you know, and I've, and a good mother and a good wife and, you know, all that sort of thing. Besides, you know, so everything in my recovery, I learned through the steps and trial and error of things. I've learned who I am, and I take care of who I am. And I take care of who I am by the way I eat. I've learned that I'm highly sensitive too. And so there's things that I don't, that I want to eat, but they hurt me. And so I learned not to eat them. It takes a while, you know, but I've just learned not to. I know that when I am physically active, I feel better. I like doing, learning new habits, because I like being on sort of autopilot. That's like where I'm at with meditation. Not meaning that I'm, when I'm meditating, I'm on autopilot, I'm present, but I'm on autopilot to where I'm going to go get my cup of coffee, and I'm going to go sit in my chair, and I'm going to pull out my journal. I'm going to light a candle and some incense. All that's autopilot. But once I sit down and I start in, that's not autopilot. It's the same as when I get up in the morning, I make my bed, you know, I brush my teeth every day. I've been doing, you know, I challenge myself, and, you know, I'm 61, I'm getting older, and I'm trying to stay, I want to stay fit, and I am, I'm pretty fit for my age. And so I've been doing push-ups every single day since May 1st, and I've already done 30 today. You know, I did 1,200 last month. So I mark it on a calendar every day. It's just something that I do every day that, you know, it's a habit now, you know. I'm always striving to feel good in my skin, because I just didn't have that growing up. And it is, even in early middle recovery or whatever, it's not. And I understand now through the steps, through listening to other people, through things that I've read and therapy and all this stuff that I've done, that it is 100% completely up to me how I am, how I turn out. That doesn't mean, I don't believe that I can choose my feelings and how I'm going to feel. I wish I could, but I can't. I deal with depression. And I've learned to go easy on myself on that one, to not, to suspend judgment of myself. I, up until, I don't know, a few years ago, maybe, I don't know how long, I have been so hard on myself. And I realized recently that I haven't been that way in a while. And I just went through a little bit of depression, and I just realized myself, luckily, I have the kind of life where I don't have to go to a 9-to-5 job. We own a few, like 3 Airbnbs, and one of them I have to clean when the guests leave. And during this, a few weeks ago, I had time off where we had a guest in there for a few days. And so I gave myself the permission to just lay on the couch and watch TV, you know, because I just couldn't do anything else, and I didn't feel bad about it, and that was really nice. It didn't used to be that way. The other thing I want to mention, and then I'm pretty well done here, is that as far as my family goes, I have absolutely no contact with them. I have chosen that, and it's that for quite a few years. I want nothing to do with them, and for me, that is totally okay, because every time I would try to engage with them, I would walk away just feeling horrible and gross and triggered, and you know, and I do not need to put myself in that position. So I have nothing to do with them. As far as I'm concerned, you are my family, and my family here is, you know, my kids and my husband, and you know, that's my family. These people were never really my family, and I don't need to try anymore. I do not need to put that on myself. So anyway, my story is one of like still plagued for, you know, by trauma, PTSD, all that sort of stuff. Wow, how is it that we can see somebody? Weird. And but through the steps, through meetings, through, I love sponsoring people. That's my service. I sponsor a lot of women, all the other kind of service, but sponsorship is my thing. Through all that, I've really kind of carved out a place. Oh, one more thing I didn't mention is I'm an artist, and it's through creativity that I feel the most alive, and beauty, seeing beauty everywhere I go, and being present. That one way through this being triggered I've learned is to be present, to sort of like breathe, and kind of I start narrating my life, you know, like if I'm in a car, I'll be going, okay, I have my hands on the steering wheel, driving down the street, I'm, you know, and just sort of narrate my life. That puts me in the moment right now. Really, really helpful. So anyway, I'm done. That's all I have to say. Thanks.